From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As President Donald Trump declares a national emergency over the outbreak of the novel coronavirus and readies a bipartisan aid package to provide relief, the big question arises, will the government once more prioritize help for the wealthiest individuals and institutions over the needs of the public? Author Naomi Klein termed it the shock doctrine. If past crises are any indication, it's to be expected that the corporate stranglehold of our political system will ensure that banks and other profitable industries will weather the COVID-19 storm, even as ordinary Americans lose jobs and homes and accrue unsustainable debt. We turn to Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. He's written a number of books, including 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, as well as Born on Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Hi, Sonali. Great to be with you.
Well, the common good is, of course, what's most needed in terms of our attention right now. I want to begin with clarifying and understanding what it was that the federal government, the federal treasury, just did a few days ago with the injection of $1.5 trillion into stabilizing, supposedly, the financial system. A lot of people have, you know, seen this as yet another bailout of the banks. They've, you know, how is it that they found $1.5 trillion of money lying about when they always tell us there's not enough money for Medicare for all, et cetera. But it's a little bit more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Yeah, there is some understandable confusion about it, given our experience of the economic bailout in 2008. This is the Federal Reserve acting. One of its responsibilities is to just make sure there is liquidity, that cash is flowing through the system. And so essentially what's happening is the Federal Reserve is making sure that there's more cash. They're doing short-term loans and what they call repos into the system, basically to keep it because there's a danger that people will stop circulating money, that there'll be sort of a seize up, and that's something that actually none of us want to do. But it sort of tapped into an understandable suspicion that the Trump administration, this administration, would sort of use the power of government to favor one class of one group over another. And I think that that's generally something we should be very concerned and vigilant about. But in the case of this $1.5 trillion infusion, it's not something that's comparable. It's not like a bailout. Right. It's not like a giveaway to a certain sector of the economy. It's actually in our interest to keep cash flowing, especially as many, many businesses now are, whole sectors are seeing customers disappear from their businesses, and that's causing people to hold on to whatever cash they have, understandably, and that's causing a shortage of cash in the system.
In fact, the suspicion is warranted given that one of the earliest responses from the Trump administration to the coronavirus was fear over the stock market's crash. We had the oil and gas sector in particular dramatically drop in prices. And Trump immediately talked about bailing out the fracking industry, which, so far that hasn't yet come to pass. But if you can see where his head is, and of course, he has always been a president by the 1% for the 1%. There is very real and understandable fear that he will prioritize bailing out industries like the fracking industry over aid to actual ordinary Americans, human beings.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
right?
With Trump, you have to realize he talks to a very limited universe of people. So Harold Hamm, who is this huge donor to the Trump campaign, one of the early sort of wildcat frackers, put a bug in his ear about, oh my God, the fracking industry is, so all of a sudden we're talking about bailout. So this is exactly, Sonali, what we should be concerned about is that, whether this will be a sort of a bailout of the billionaires or a people's bailout, and what are the kinds of things that we should be doing that would actually help both the economy and help, low income and working people survive this economic situation. But it's true. We should be, given the sort of cronyism and character of this administration, we should be very suspicious when the list comes up, whether it's airlines or fracking industries or other sort of friendly industries to the powerful.
And we should also remind ourselves that it's not just Republican administrations that have bailed out big industries. It was under Obama that we saw the bailout of the big banks after the Great Recession. It was in the Bush administration when, you know, the Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and you even saw local and state governments, forget about the federal governments, taking advantage of the crisis there to privatize education. Over and over and over again, we've seen, and I cited Naomi Klein, elites who have the most using those resources to push further deregulation, to use the shock of a disaster and a vulnerable population that's teetering to find its feet to then push policies that make them, you know, that are better for them, and that in the long term will hurt us again and again and again. So here's my question to you. It hasn't always been that way, right, Chuck? There was a time, if we go all the way back to, say, the Great Depression, where you had a different response. You had the New Deal.
No, and I think it's very important that you're lifting up Naomi Klein's construct of the, you know, the shock doctrine, because one of the things that happens when a society is undergoing shock, which is what we're going through right now, is the most... But both powerful people try to move their agenda, but also other good ideas that, as Milton Friedman said, people embrace the good ideas that are lying around. So clearly there's sort of a neoliberal economic elite agenda, but there's also, and I think your example of the New Deal is, well, let's, you know, what were some of the things of the New Deal? We created Social Security. We created a pension program for elders. We created the minimum wage. We passed the minimum wage to lift the floor. We actually put very steeply progressive taxes on the most wealthy people in the society to pay for public investments that stimulated the economy and also lifted up millions of people. So what are our good ideas? I mean, people have been talking about paid family sick leave as a form of a benefit, universal health insurance. So this is also a moment to lift up some of the best progressive ideas, just like in the New Deal that we've been advocating for a while, and say, look, this situation will be so much better. You know, one of the challenges right now is the federal government does not have a lot of tools to deal with the economic downturn. We have, interest rates are so low because even though the 2008 economic meltdown has long passed, we've essentially juicing the economy with low credit, the quantitative easing policies of the last decade, et cetera. So here we're in a situation where we've been dismantling the tools and we've been chipping away at the social safety net, which is so vital in a time like this. So things like unemployment insurance, debt relief, canceling evictions and reducing student debt or forgiving student debt, all those things would actually have a powerful positive stimulus in the economy right now and would unleash positive economic changes as opposed to more concentration of wealth and power.
And there, I want to pick up on what you just said. There are a very, there's a very strong case to be made for a number of incredibly sound policy ideas that we have just been having a major national political discourse around, such as Medicare for All, such as the Green New Deal, such as raising the federal minimum wage, all of these policy proposals, ideas, plans lifted up by the Bernie Sanders campaign for president and available in time when we need it the most. The big question is, what will Americans choose? Because there are also voters making decisions right now. And in the last few primary elections, we've seen voters choosing somebody who has already very explicitly promised to return to the status quo. And that's Joe Biden.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the good news is that the population and voters are pushing the conversation and pushing candidate Joe Biden and Senator Sanders' race and Senator Warren and others have sort of pushed the conversation so that we are talking about a Green New Deal. We are talking about sort of a big fix for the economy. And, you know, I think it's very important to talk about unequal sacrifice in a moment like this, where, you know, as millions of people are potentially at risk of losing their jobs, people who, you know, in a variety of sectors that are being affected are going to be struggling in the coming months and in the next year. And, you know, do we create a new federal jobs guaranteed job of last resort kind of intervention in a moment like this, where we could direct resources to something like a Green New Deal, building new green infrastructure, things that actually will help both get us out of an economic downturn, but actually move us toward the sort of society we need to have. And unequal sacrifice means that the billionaire class, which has done so well in the last 40 years, really, should pay their fair share of taxes, should be, you know, we should be talking about taxing the top at much more progressive levels. So just like the New Deal of the 1930s, we should be looking at ways to make sure that everybody is contributing to this transition, and we don't have war, essentially the equivalent of war profiteers in the current economy who are buffered because they have friends in the federal government buffered from the upheavals.
I want to turn back also to another thing that you mentioned, which is about interest rates. We started out trying to clarify what exactly the Federal Reserve did in injecting $1.5 trillion into stabilizing financial markets. But it's also been reducing interest rates. And we now know that in the coming days, those interest rates are going to be cut to zero. What does that mean exactly? Is this something that ought to be actually viewed as a bailout of sorts?
Well, it shows the point I'm making, which is they don't have a lot of tools in the toolbox, meaning that they've kind of been propping up the investor class, if you will.
Right. Already, interest
decade.
Rates were pushed far lower than they ought to have been before the coronavirus crisis.
Yeah. So unlike say 12 years ago, when interest rates were cut to help the economy, the interest rates were much higher at that point. And to bring them down actually did have sort of a stimulus. But it does say, you know, it basically brings us to the question of, well, what else is there? I mean, do we go into negative interest rate territory? Again, these are things that the investor class benefits from. But I think this is where, you know, whether you're a candidate for president or the current president, how we talk about getting the economy moving again. There's so many other tools in the toolbox if you are open to them, including borrowing to invest, borrowing to provide support for people. You know, there are 44 million people in this country who have student debt, 44 million households, $1.3 trillion. That's a huge drag on the economy. It has no positive benefit except to extract wealth from low and middle income families. So actually eliminating student debt frees up people to make bottom up investments in their own lives and spend money in the economy that's much more effective than continuing to help the wealthy investor classes with, you know, keep continuing to reduce interest rates. Now, many people, the cost of borrowing goes down. For people who are trying to be first-time homebuyers, it's not just the wealthy that benefit from low interest rates, but we should be entirely looking at all the other possible tools to strengthen the economy at this moment.
And we should also remind ourselves, Chuck, shouldn't we, that the capitalist system that and the unfettered neoliberal economic policies we've adopted, the deregulations we've adopted, have made this system more and more vulnerable to crashes. And when you have unforeseen disasters like the coronavirus, that raises that vulnerability even more. But over and over again, we have these cyclical crashes. It's never a matter of if the market will crash, but when.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been surprised how, I've been looking at sort of what I would call underlying signs of trouble for a while. Declining home ownership rate, the fact that 40% of the population has zero or negative wealth, very little financial reserves to fall back on. Really, one out of five households have zero or negative wealth, and the next fifth have very little. I mean, there are all kinds of brittle and vulnerable places in our economy, and the ruling parties have basically been pushing to just keep the band playing so that they can extract as much wealth out of the healthy economy as possible. But it was only a matter of time until we sort of hit this. And I think, you know, another important thing to think about in this moment is, well, how do we relocalize the economy? I mean, how do we, here we're seeing the collapse of global supply chain. But the fact is, there's probably things that we could be making in our own community. We could be building more resilient, healthy local food systems, systems of production.
We're That's a really great point, because our global economy has been designed to maximize profit and minimize costs. And if it means getting raw materials from really far away, like China, just because transportation costs are low, labor costs are low, material costs are low, we've been doing that. But now when you have a disaster like this, where your supply chain gets interrupted and suddenly you have no supplies from a lot closer, you see this vulnerability in the economy, and this globalized economy has these huge, huge vulnerabilities. There's also this sense, you know, that right now, as we take on this crisis of the coronavirus, you have messages from people like Bernie Sanders who are reminding us that his slogan, "Not me, us," is so relevant more than ever at a time like this. Solidarity is critical. But, you know, people are also deeply worried, and this instinct to, you know, hoard the toilet paper is kicking in. But shouldn't we also be reminding ourselves there's a very tiny group of people that have been hoarding the vast amount of money in our economy for much longer than the coronavirus? And that's a huge disaster.
Yeah, no, I think that one of our biggest vulnerabilities are these extreme inequalities of wealth and power, that if you keep re-rigging the economy to funnel wealth to the top, that is going to create economic upheaval. And I think this is a time to say, you know, can we strengthen local institutions of mutual aid? Can we watch out for our neighbors? Should we, you know, we're not going to get through this alone. I mean, I understand some people are literally in quarantine, but the reality is we will have to depend on one another in our communities. And then I think back to a policy level, part of a Green New Deal program should be, how do we build healthy, resilient economies? And resilient means you don't depend on one source in the world for something. You create duplicate capacity. You have more of your calories produced within an hour of where you live when possible. You build up regional and local energy systems and production systems when possible. And a Green New Deal is one of the ways that you can sort of redirect spending and investment to sort of help that happen. So I think we both have to address the extreme inequalities and restore progressivity in the tax system, and a wealth tax and a progressive inheritance tax to help pay for a transition to a healthy, more regionalized economy.
the Trump administration has made very clear where its mind is at. Trump, the news is around food stamp cuts is that planned food stamp cuts from before the coronavirus crisis hit are going to continue. Trump also has refused so far to allow states to use Medicaid funds to combat the coronavirus. I mean, it's just remarkable that he would continue to do this. He seems to think that if he can spin the news in a positive way, regardless of the reality, that he will ensure his reelection, because that overall seems to be his number one priority. The question is, how long can he keep fooling his own base?
Yeah, I mean, I think your example of Medicaid is a powerful example. I mean, here, states could be using it. States just need the federal government to give them both the approval and the go-ahead, basically, to deploy resources to address the coronavirus and to bring more people into Medicaid and get more people covered under health insurance so that they can get tested and treated. And it may be his reluctance, you know, maybe with the declaration of a state of emergency, that will change. But this basically this government has been dragging its feet. And, you know, I think if people honestly look around and see what's happening to our communities, and I'm here in Boston and looking around New England, you know, we're in for many, many months of both public health and economic challenges here. And if you have a president who's in denial, how is that going to really help us move forward here? So once again, I'm hoping people look around and voters look around and say, you know, are we really going to be better off continuing on down this path of denial and cronyism when it comes to our personal health and the health of the economy?
The wealthy have so much money in the country and in the world today that they don't have to worry about paid sick leave, about healthcare, about the price or the cost of testing if they feel symptoms, about weathering a storm, about losing one contract, about their kids staying home from school. None of that is going to affect them because they are so immune to the travails of daily life. They're so cushioned from reality with the billions and the trillions they've hoarded. This is also a really critical time to talk about taxing the hell out of the rich. Yes, we've talked about the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, but all of that money that they've been hoarding at the top needs to be pulled out, extracted from their grips, and flooded into our revenues, right? I mean, enough with the tax cuts. We need massive, massive high 90%, 100% taxes on the wealthiest Americans.
No, you know, we've just done some research showing that the billionaire class has seen their taxes go down 70% in the last four decades. That the richest 400 people's effective tax rate is 23%, which is lower than the middle income households in this country. I think we need a oligarchy or a plutocracy prevention tax program. So, you know, an annual wealth tax that Senator Warren has put forward and Bernie Sanders has put forward, a progressive inheritance tax and a state tax that slows those intergenerational transfers, an income tax, a surtax on incomes over a couple $1 million. All these are taxes paid by the top 0.1%, where most of the income and wealth is now concentrating.
And they will not miss any of that money. They will continue to be able to have multi-million dollar homes and yachts and be able to pass millions down to their children. They will not miss any of it.
No, and you know, one thing that our group has looked a lot at is how much wealth is being hidden. We estimate some $20 trillion. The super rich are hiding $20 trillion plus in offshore tax havens and trusts. Some of it's invested here in the United States in luxury real estate, but it's anonymously owned. There is an enormous amount of private wealth in the hands of this top 0.1%. And I'm very worried that we're going to start to hear the austerity rhetoric soon. You know, oh, we can't afford to make these kind of investments. We can't afford to respond to the the pandemic in a in with because we don't have the resources. We can't invest in a Green New Deal. There is so much wealth that could be deployed for the common good in this moment. And so we shouldn't fall for the we're broke story. The wealth is here. It is concentrated in very few hands, and we should be very alarmed and concerned about
Well,
that.
if we run out of food, let's eat the rich. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us. What's a good website for people to find out more about the work you do?
Yes, please come visit us at inequality.org and see what we're doing and see the commentaries and analysis and actions that you can take to address these inequalities. And we have a little weekly newsletter that has a sense of humor. So you should sign up for that in these sometimes humorless times.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today. Stay safe out there, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again very soon.
Mind yourselves, everybody.
Chuck Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs a program on inequality and the common good. He's written a number of books, including 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, and Born on Third Base, a One Percenter, makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. We've been discussing the federal government's response to the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.